entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Greetings. Welcome in. It's Sunday morning, the 19th day of January. And it's the best of Downtown, brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength, by Quirk Motor City Used Vehicle Center, locations in Augusta, Bangor, Belfast, and Portland. It's your car. Find it at QuirkAuto.com. Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell here with you. And time for our look back at some favorite recent conversations, three mighty fine ones for you from the previous week here on the Best of Downtown. Coming up a little later in the broadcast, we talk with actress, activist, stand-up comedian, and author Allison Arngrim. Nellie Olson from Little House on the Prairie will talk with us about her role in that series and how it impacted her life in many ways. Very fun conversation with her coming up later in the program this Sunday morning. Also, we'll talk with Jay Jaffe of Fangraphs, author of the Cooperstown Casebook, and get his thoughts on who should be going into the Baseball Hall of Fame this coming week and who is likely to go in. We get things underway this morning by catching up with our friend Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. With a lot going on in the sports scene, we focused with Bob early on a conversation about the baseball scandal and its impact so far on the Houston Astros, the Boston Red Sox, and the New York Mets. Here's Bob Ryan on the Best of Downtown. My goodness, what a week it has been in baseball. Did you see any of this coming?
Well, back when? I mean, how far back do we have to backtrack? The story? No, seriously. I mean, what do you mean? Did I see it coming last Sunday? Did I see it coming starting with the heads that fell in Houston, followed by the Cora head, followed by the Beltran head. So I guess we felt, I would say all of this was logically predictable a week ago, the end result would, not the end result, but one of the results would be the Astros and the Red Sox and the Mets would all lose their managers. So I think it was quite predictable.
And it seems to be like peeling an onion. The more we learn, the worse it gets. Now we're hearing about players with buzzers. We've moved past just banging trash cans in this one.
Yeah, I love the trash can thing. Talk about elementary. I was amused in the beginning, thinking the marketing prospects. You know, you can have a hardware store sponsor. You know, with the trash can, the Houston Astros trash can of the Astros. You know, but all kidding aside, this thing is appalling, and it's the last thing baseball needed, because baseball has enough problems with the length of the game and the down trend in attendance and trying to attract young people to the game as spectators, and the last thing you need is a game in which people are now being told was not being conducted on the up and up starting in 2017, and who knows how far back it goes or how widespread it is. Have we nailed all the perps? No one can say right now.
And what happens, first of all, with some of the individuals? I mean, A.J. Hinch, Alex Cora, highly respected guys who seem to be at the beginning of great careers. People had high hopes for Beltran. Do they become absolute pariahs in the game now?
That's the question. I wondered about a lot. I certainly wondered about that, what the future is. What is their future chance of employment in this game? I don't know. We do know one thing. We know that there's the American society is notorious, famously forgiving. Certain people have resurrected themselves. It fascinates me that A-Rod has resurrected himself semi-respectability. He's a television face. The Yankees have put him back on the payroll. And he was the only player in the history of the game that's suspended for a year for transgressions of any nature. Managers were. You know, Leo Durocher was famously suspended in 47 for, quote-unquote, consorting with gamblers, unquote. But anyway, A-Rod's been resurrected. But a lot of other people haven't been, and along the way. No, I wonder about that. I seriously wonder about that. And Alex Cora is 42 years old. Granted, he's made money. He made money as a player, more than you and I make, for sure. He's made money, put away some good money as a Red Sox manager in those 2 years, and they are paying him still. But, he's got to work. And Hinch, I don't know how old Hinch is. But, yeah, you're right. They were respected guys. And Beltran's just on starting his new life, you know, it was just starting it with, as a manager after being a renowned player. I don't know what this future holds for any of them.
The irony is that sign stealing has been an honored part of the game forever. We talked to the late Ralph Branca a number of years ago, and then he chatted about how Bobby Thompson was getting the signs. Is it the use of technology that it's taken it to this dark place?
I've got to back up here. Sign stealing with your eyes has been an accepted part of baseball and a legitimate part of baseball, for 100-plus years. There's no question about it. There's nothing wrong with trying to decipher and sniff out signs with your eyes. Once you introduce technology. Now, the Bobby Thompson thing, I'm unclear on this. Everybody's kicking around this idea that Branca went to his, knew for years and complained for years about the possibility or the Giants had stolen signs. That is not my take on that. My take is I read the book, Jonathan Eich. It all was revealed in the Jonathan Eich book, Echoing Green. And it wasn't until that book came out that the whole thing was outlined. And so I think from that point on, Branca, then he found out. He and Thompson were famously paired up for appearances for years.
Right.
They became friends. And then after the revelation that – then Branca, so it wasn't like he was saying this for 50 years. No. And by the way, I know I'm on the side that you probably don't need, but I'm here. I might as well do it. I don't care if Thompson knew that fastball was coming on that 1-0 count. The ball was up around his neck, okay? And when you listen to the it was an improbable swing on an improbable pitch to start with. And even if he knew it was coming, the ball was around his neck. He didn't groove one, okay? I listened to that recording as a kid a billion times. I have that record, The Greatest Moments of Sports from CBS Sports.
The Russ Hodges call?
Yes, and then after that, the locker room, all the interviews, and you can hear Branca, and he's saying, I'll hear Thompson say, it was a bad high inside fastball. That's exactly what it was, a bad high inside. So I am saying that Thompson's home run was not the result of stealing the sign. I don't care how many other signs. Now, what I am pained by as a Giant fan of longstanding, of growing up, the Giants won 37 of the last 44 games that year to catch the Dodgers after being down 13.5 games on August 11th. And obviously they benefited if their signs were being stolen to win many of those games. And had they not won one fewer game, had they won one fewer game, the Dodgers, there wouldn't have been a three-game playoff for the pennant, and the Dodgers would have won the National League pennant.
Speaking of iconic baseball moments, I love the memories that you shared on social media with the passing of Don Larsen of hustling home because you heard something was happening when Larsen threw that perfect game in the World Series.
Sure. In our neighborhood, and I lived in a neighborhood with where we all played together and all the seasonal sports around the year. I went to a parochial school, and when you go to parochial school and the nuns are baseball fans, you're going to have their game one on the radio. And that's exactly what happened at St. Joseph's School on Sherman Avenue in Trenton, New Jersey. And so we knew that when we got on the bus that something good was happening, that Larsen was throwing a perfect game through like six. It took me about 10 minutes to get home. I walked in and watched the rest of the game, which ended, by the way, as you probably can guess, in about 2 hours and 10 minutes. it started at 1, it was over by 3:10, and then you go out and play touch football. A lot of people could relate to that grew up in those times, that's the way life was.
We're talking with Bob Ryan here on Downtown. You spoke eloquently about the late David Stern on your podcast. How important is he to the history of the NBA?
One of the two most important non-playing figures in the game, and along with Red Auerbach, and who had his influence, obviously, on the court as well as, executive. But in terms of taking the game and helping transform it as a business property from a mom-and-pop store, which it still was essentially in the early 80s, relatively speaking, to what it has now become, an international conglomerate, where its tentacles are in several continents. It was his vision that was able to get this propelled in the right direction. He recognized, and he was very greatly benefited by the holy trinity of 80s basketball, Magic and Larry as first, and then Michael coming along. And Magic and Larry set the table, and Michael got the meal produced. And Stern was the was the chef, and got it done. No question. You can't. All these owners today whose franchises are worth upwards of $1 billion, and in the case of the Clippers, if the Clippers are worth $2 billion, you know, what are the other teams worth? They have to thank David Stern.
And as you mentioned, too, he was unique because he was also an approachable commissioner.
Oh, he was, you know, there were guys, you know, he had his, there were people in the media that he clashed with and were the victims were the going to receiving end of his somewhat rapier wit at times, who didn't look as didn't feel as finely about David Stern as I did. But there are plenty of us on my side, but he was approachable and he liked dealing with the media and appreciated the media as a basketball fan, which he was to the core.
Speaking of your podcast, which is absolutely wonderful, you got a special offer going through Patreon for people to become patrons and get some bonus Bob Ryan podcast material.
Well, that's true, and I can't even speak to the intricacies of this. I'm going along for the ride. I'm glad that people are able to promote me in that fashion, but I am happy to have that taking place. And yeah, you know, it's a podcast world. It's an amazing thing. I'm going to tell you something very quickly. When I first had a podcast in 2017, the creator of my podcast said, "How many podcasts do you think are out there?" I said, "I don't know, 25,000, 50,000. At that point, 3 years ago, as we speak, there were 350,000. So I would think that the number is approaching seven figures now.
Oh, it has to be. Absolutely.
On every topic, you can imagine. Stamp collecting, I'm sure. You know, obviously, God knows the most predominant ones are on politics, sports, and entertainment in some fashion. But every conceivable niche is being accounted for in the podcast world.
Bob, which college basketball team do you find most entertaining this season?
So far, in the ones I've seen, and I need to really hope I can step it up, Gonzaga at their best. They're good. They really are good. And they're unlikely to lose. You know, I can't see them being dislodged unless they stumble and by only beating teams by 6 or 8 instead of beating them by 20. But I expect that they're going to romp through the league as they often do and maintain that. But that doesn't mean that they're the predominant favorites. I'm just talking about being number one. I enjoy them. I haven't seen enough of all the teams this year, and it is a very odd year. Because so often we do talk about it being wide open, and in reality, it comes down to there's only five or six teams that could ever, you could say, win those six games in a row to win the tournament. This year, there might really be double-figure teams that could put those six games in a row together, which I think will make for a really fabulous March.
We had the Oscar nominations earlier this week. What's the best movie you saw last year?
That's a good question. I would say it's a photo finish. You know, we had to get the Marriage Story over Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Mm.
Marriage Story but I'll say this to people who haven't seen it. Someone described it to me this way: if you go with your wife or significant other, and your relationship is solid and good at that moment, you're going to like the movie. If you go with your SO or your wife, and things are a bit rocky, oh boy, you're going to walk out of there. You might take separate cabs home.
Oh dear.
So just warning people, it's powerful. It's extremely well written. It's extraordinarily well acted by Adam Driver and oh my God, tell me.
Yeah, Scarlett Johansson.
Well acted. Yeah, right. And it's wonderful. But Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I just enjoyed it. It was a great ride. It's a little bloody in the end. If people don't know.
Yeah.
But to get there, there's a lot of laughs and a lot of good bonhomie between DiCaprio and Pitt. And people seem to think Pitt's a shoe-in to win Best Supporting, but it's a very powerful. There's several very powerful categories, and that's one of them.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe with us here on the Best of Downtown on your Sunday morning. When we return, Nellie Olson, Little House on the Prairie's Alison Arngrim, will talk with us about that role and what it did to her and then eventually for her. It's up next here on Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
You love going out to eat and saving money. Well, the Ground Round in Bangor has different weekly specials every day of the week. Plus, happy hour at the Ground Round is way more than just 1 hour. During happy hour, you can get an appetizer for just $1.99 when you get another app at full price. And full mugs of Bud, Bud Light, Coors, and Miller Lite are just $2.99. Happy hour at the Ground Round is every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. and from 9 p.m. to close. And Sunday all day is happy hour too. Want more details? Visit online at groundround.com.
Hi, this is Mike Toole of ClearPoint Capital in Bangor. I've been an investment advisor for over 25 years. Our firm is local, independent, and now with the addition of my two children, John and Jillian, we're truly a family business. At ClearPoint Capital, we help our clients grow and protect their investments to help meet their goals. Why not see what our team can do for you? Give us a call today at 307-7718 to schedule a free consultation. ClearPoint Capital. Our family helping yours.
Winter's here. Winter's cold weather and snow is finally arriving. Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street in Bangor, wants you to be ready for it. Bring your vehicle in right now and have it checked before the really cold weather kicks in. They'll check the battery, antifreeze, shocks, alignment, and don't forget the snow tires. Don't wait. For once, get ahead of the really cold winter weather. Make your appointment today. Call Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street, or check them out on the web at bangortire.com. Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street, Bangor. More than just a tire store.
Rebates have doubled. Yep, doubled for our most efficient heat pump systems. At Valley Home Services, get $1,000 off your first system and $500 off your second. And don't wait for the rebate. Valley Home Services provides rebates instantly. With combined savings and financing options, now is the best time to have Valley Home Services install your heat pump system. Double rebates. Call now for your free consultation and start saving up to 50% on heating and cooling. Valley Home Services, home is our middle name. For a generation of television fans, you only need to hear a few notes to know that that is the theme song from Little House on the Prairie, a longtime hit on the NBC television network. Our next guest starred in the series as the annoying, mean, nasty Nellie Olson. Alison Arngrim eventually learned to embrace the reaction to that character. She chronicled it first in a memoir, and then a one-woman show entitled Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. Here's our very interesting conversation with Alison Arngrim. You got some busy things happening in your life here. You've got a birthday coming up, an early happy birthday to you, and a trip to France, where we know from the book they absolutely love you.
It's true. They are. It's crazy. I mean, Little House in the Prairie is just, over the years, has become more and more popular all over the world. But the French, they love it. And I find they kind of like Nellie Olson best. I think they don't think she's mean. They think she's French.
Well, I was late, and I don't know why I was late to reading your book, because it came out a number of years ago. But I'm so glad I got to it. It was laugh out loud funny. It was poignant. It was inspiring in so many ways as well.
Oh, thank you. I'm so pleased. And that's something I've noticed. I go on Amazon. I'm like, some of these reviews are from last week. People are still buying it. They're still ordering Amazon whenever I go to an event or a show. And I had an edition come out in France. And even at the shows I'm doing in France, I have to have a stack of them on the table. People just can't get enough of it.
Well, I want to talk about your background. You've had a more than interesting life. And let's start at the beginning. Is it safe to say that your parents had a unique relationship?
I think, to put it mildly, I mean, that's the thing, as they used to say, we'd you know, they'd go to parties in the 70s and 80s, and they'd laugh and say, your parents invented parties like this. usually people of older parents think of them, people who married in the 50s, as being very stodgy. But no, and this is, they met back in the theater in Canada. And but my father was openly, well, openly bisexual to my mother. I don't think the neighbors knew in the 50s and 60s, but my mother did. And they thought this was just completely hunky-dory.
Your mom was an incredibly talented and successful voiceover artist, was the voice of Casper and Gumby, Sweet Polly Purebred. And I didn't know until reading the book, she was also on the first family album with Maine native Von Meter.
Yes, that's right. He's from Maine. People remember this, the first family album. It's become iconic because the cover artwork, where it's photoshopped, that they're all standing in front of the White House. And you see this picture, and there's what appears to be a young woman with a balloon who obviously is doing the children's voices. That's my mom. She's like 40 in that picture, just, you know, 22 or something. But, yeah, my mother was the voice of Caroline and John John on the album where Von Meter was portraying JFK. And there's actually, for a collector, two albums, the famous one, and there was First Family 2, where they had a lot of songs, they had parody songs and things. Unfortunately, it was released just a couple of weeks before the assassination. And so most people do not own a copy of the number two album.
One of the
find one, it's a big collector.
Well, exactly. One of the most difficult parts of the book to read, and obviously difficult for you to experience and write about, is the fact that you were assaulted for many years by your brother. Was it important for you to talk about that and get it out there in the world?
Yeah, because what I found out in as I, over the years I started talking about this is it is so common. I mean, when you talk to people who work in child abuse, they will tell you flat out that, unfortunately, the majority of abuse cases, sexual abuse cases, the victim knows the attacker, the abuser is known to the victim in 85-90% of the cases, and in the majority of cases, it's a family member. It's the father or the stepfather or the grandfather or the brother or the uncle. I actually had a defense attorney, during a radio show, we're on a show together, a defense attorney actually tell me that in 25 years of working in the defense, for people being tried for sexual abuse, he had never had a case where it wasn't the father.
Wow.
Now, that's a pretty horrifying and damning statement, but apparently this is it. And when I've started talking about having been abused, the number of people said they were abused by their brother or stepbrother, and they didn't know who to tell. They said, well, everyone talks about the father, stepfather, but it was my grandpa or it was my brother, and they didn't know who to tell. And families often leave their children with someone they trust. And they think, okay, I didn't hire a babysitter from outside. It was a close family friend. It's a relative. What could possibly go wrong? And unfortunately, most people who are sexually abused by a close family friend or relative.
And that makes the law that you helped overturn in California all that more mind-boggling to me, that under the provisions of this law, these child protection laws that you worked with the protect.org people to defeat, there was almost an exemption made for people who were close relatives and, what, even personal friends.
It's absolutely the craziest thing in the world, and it's in a lot of states. We knocked it out of about seven states. We managed to change this law in California, New York, and several other states. But it's extremely common to have an exception made in the sexual abuse jail sentences for people who are related to the victim, which is crazy because it's not an exception the majority of time. It's going to be a relative. Or as they said, in the law, they actually coded this in the law, or someone living in the home like a family member. And I thought, good Lord, does that mean house guests, boarders? I mean, who are you including here? And in California, the most egregious offenses, I mean, all the worst stuff, continuous abuse, multiple victims, all of this was included. But then it would say, but a person could be eligible for probation with absolutely no time served and even deferred entry of judgment where they have no record. That person has no record after being convicted of multiple counts of sexual abuse only because it's a relative. So we managed to change that in California and several other states, but it's still going on. It's a major problem. It's sort of deep-seated in the law that people are just, they're in such denial. There's people who don't want to believe that it's the relatives. And so people who are convicted sex offenders and their attorneys can swoop in and create these kind of loopholes in the law.
Well, when you decided to go public in a big way by sharing your story on Larry King, it may be my favorite moment of the book, the reaction of your dad when you told him.
Yes, because, well, as I said, my family, kind of nuts and very in show business. And my father, my manager, was so absolutely, his head was so completely into the publicity. There's a chapter about my father called The Publicity Seeking Missile. He was so obsessed with showbiz and publicity that when I called him to tell him I was going public on Larry King about being sexually abused, instead of being worried about what people would think or being, oh, my God, you poor thing, he went, oh, wait, you have the whole hour? Is it just you on Larry King? Who else is on? You're on for the whole hour? Oh, my God, I'm throwing a party. I need to call a caterer. He began discussing calling a caterer to have people in because he was so excited that, well, I was on CNN for an entire hour. This was a great coup. And I was like, you do understand what I just said I was going to be talking about. And he said, yes, yes, of course. Well, that's very, you should be doing that. Oh, my God, the whole hour. And it took him hours to come down from the sort of the ceiling of this is an incredible press moment that she has gotten the hour to, oh, my God, my daughter is telling this story.
We're talking with Allison Arngrim here on Downtown. So many wonderful stories about the making of Little House on the Prairie and the people involved in that. I was very happy to learn what an incredible mensch Melissa Gilbert is.
Yes, yes. Absolutely, yes. We got along like a house of fire. She's like my little sister, and she's a really cool person. It's funny because, you know, she wound up becoming president of the Screen Actors Guild, and I tell a story in the book. She was organizing the actors when she was 9 and 10 years old when, you know, the stage mothers would start rumors and try to pit the child actors against each other. She would call a meeting in her dressing room and have us all in and say, okay, we need to nip this in the bud right now. We have to stick together. And so when she wound up becoming an organizer for the Actors Union, well, that's not surprising.
You had a great response when people asked you, did you love Michael Landon? Did he love you? And you didn't talk about love. You talked about respect.
Yes. And that's so rare. And it's rare in Hollywood. And for child actors, it's unheard of. Very often child actors, you know, it's the nature of the business. Sometimes as a child, you're cast because you have the right color hair. They've hired two people to play the parents, and they want a kid who looks like them. And that the main factor in your getting the job is not necessarily your performance, but are you short, and do you look like the people who have been hired to play your parents? And that can be a little difficult. But they're often treated as props. And so a lot of child actors will tell you that they were treated like the furniture on the shows that they were on. It was very difficult for them. But on Little House, all of us found that we were treated with an enormous amount of respect, that we were held very accountable. We were expected to do the work and know our lines and like a grown person. We were treated as actors. And, well, I tell the story, but the guy, the assistant director, he wanted to hand out candy and gum to the kids at the end of the day, because we had so many children with the atmosphere of the school kids, the extras. And he said, and Michael asked him to stop doing it. And said, no. He said, they don't need gum. They're actors. They get their paycheck at the end of the week. But they're not trained animals. And he said, I don't want them doing that because it's not really respectful. They're not little trained dogs that you have to give a treat to. They're adults. They're like adults in that respect. They're actors. And I expect them to be doing their job because they're doing their job.
Melissa Sue Anderson was, just, I guess we'd say, a tough nut to crack. You tried. A lot of people tried. At the end of the book, you expressed hope that someday maybe she would come around. Has that happened?
Not completely, but you know, we had a cast reunion thing in, 2014 was our 40th reunion. We just had our 45th reunion. Crazy. Wow. 45th anniversary. And our 40th reunion, a group of us were on the Today Show in New York. And we came in, and Melissa Sue Anderson, at the last minute, she's agreed to show up. We're sort of sure Melissa Sue Anderson is coming. And we said, well, what on earth? Some of us hadn't talked to her in ages. So what is this going to be like? And, you know, she was so nice. She was nice all day. And, of course, it's terrible to say, but we were sort of turning to each other after the first 2 hours and going, she's been nice for 2 hours. What's gotten into her? But I don't know if it's because she moved to Montreal. She's very happy with her husband. Maybe the pressure of show business. She didn't feel quite as pressured to be perfect and on all the time. I don't know. But she, that day, she seemed terribly relaxed and seemed very happy on the day of her 40th anniversary. So we said, there's hope. There's hope for her.
Allison, do you think the respect that you were talking about that Michael Landon sort of showed to the child actors of the series really helped with the success of a show that was so focused on the child's as on the children as the story of the show?
Absolutely. I mean, people to this day, I mean, that's what I mean. 45 years, who the heck's watching a show 45 years later? But there they are. I mean, it just blows my mind. 45 years later, and it's all over the world. And I ask people, you know, people in Sri Lanka and all over the world watching the show, I'm like, why are you into Little House on the Prairie? Makes no sense. And I ask them why, and they have this emotional bond with the show. And you wouldn't have that if the children's performances were overly canned or trite and not realistic. Mm-hmm. People would not have been sucked into it and be crying at every episode. There was something very real and very raw and emotional about a lot of the children's performances that made an impact. So it wasn't just the adults. If it was too fake, if the kids were just hitting their mark and saying a cute line, it would not have worked. And I think that's why all these years later, we have not only people going back and watching, but people who weren't even born when this thing was on. And they're watching it now. They're watching it. It's streaming on Amazon. And I'm just blown away every single day when I find out this is happening. But I think it is absolutely, it's the direction of Michael Landon, it's the performances, and it holds up.
Speaking of reaction, obviously a huge reaction to Nellie Olson. The first time you realized what that reaction might be, if I remember from the book, it was when you were going to school and somebody yelled at you from across the school grounds.
It's horrifying, but true. I knew I was playing the villain, and once I got the role, I was like, oh, wow, this is crazy. Okay, I'm the villain. Well, this is all going to be a whole world here. And I always admired the villains in films, TV shows. So I thought, well, that'll be fun. And then I shot the thing, and I had a good time doing it, and then I go to school, and I'm like, okay, now it has shown. It's been on TV. This is amazing. And as I said, I wasn't terribly popular in school. And so I thought, well, hey, now I'm on television. Maybe this will help. And I walked on the grounds at 8 o'clock in the morning, and this girl screams as soon as I'm the only one on the ground, and she yells on the top of the thing at me, you bitch! Oh, my God, what do? I go home? Do I just leave? Or do I? And I thought, well, I guess this is the beginning. I mean, this is how people are going to be. What do you do? And as I said in the book, it's absolutely true. At that second, it did dawn on me. I went, okay, this is what people are going to do. Do I run? I mean, I could turn around and go home and call my parents and get a ride or something. Or what do I do? Because how I react to this one, this is going to set the tone for the rest of the thing. And so I looked up at her and I said, thank you, and bowed. I took my curtain call. I was like, yes, ma'am. And I thought, that's it. I'm going to have to embrace this and run with it now. Or, that's it. I'm chopped liver here.
Can you talk about what you call the Bette Midler school of overcompensation?
Oh, my God, this is so true. So, and I did. I was a kid and I went, it's the Bette Midler school of overcompensation. So I was very shy when I was little. And, partly, yes, it was the abuse, but it was small for my age. And yay, I was smart. I got bumped up like half a grade. But when you're already small for your age and smaller than like everyone in your class. And then they're like, let's move her up a grade. So it's like, so I was very shy. I had everything going against me. And I was hearing about these actors, and I was so short also that they weren't sure I was going to grow. I kind of got to 4'8" and kind of stayed there for a while. And my mother started saying things. Well, Nancy Walker, this actress, she's had a good career. And I'm like, oh, great, I'm Rhoda's mother. So at the time, all these really short actresses. I'm 5'4" now, thank you, I grew it. But I started reading about these actresses, and I read that Bette Midler, who's a huge star even back in the 70s, Bette Midler, this brassy, incredible, wild lady with the onstage persona, that she was painfully, painfully shy all through, like, junior high, even to high school. And she sort of created this persona in public and on stage to sort of fight that. And then I read about Nancy Walker, who played Rhoda's mom and many, many other great roles. She was always played these tough, tough characters. And she said, no, no, very shy, very retiring, kind of scared of people, kind of created this character. And all her characters are these women people were terrified of. And I started reading about these actresses who were shy but played the complete opposite, and people were, if anything, intimidated by. And I thought, well, here's a good idea. and so I called it the Bette Midler School of Overcompensation. And I started trying these tactics. I was really young, like I said, I was 11, 12 years old on the show. And I started, okay, what if when I walk into a room full of people and my immediate feeling is, you know, my stomach is doing backflips. I'm like, I should just leave. If I didn't leave, if I just marched up to someone, went, hi, and started talking to people, what if I was bold and wore bright colors and marched in and was like, yes, I'm here. Hi, how are you? What would happen? I mean, what's the worst that could happen? I'm already feeling terrified, like I'm going to die. It's going to get worse. What? No. And I started doing that. And it was, people don't know. They don't know. They don't know if you're shy or not unless you act like it. And it worked in this crazy way. It actually worked. And the other trick was my Auntie Marion, very shy woman, brilliant woman, very shy. She said, you know, people talk about themselves. You go to someone at a party and you just say, oh, and what do you do? She said, don't go on for days. She said, oh, fascinating. Mm-hmm. Really, you don't say. She said, you eat your sandwich and you drink your tea and you nod your head and they do all the talking. And she was right. So you can go to the party. You can go to the job interview. You can do what you have to do if you're shy. You can fake it. And there are tricks you can use. And I have friends who are shy, and I encourage them because it's very painful. I hate being shy. But absolutely, I saw how a number of famous people did this. And it's a hell of a trick, and I highly recommend it.
You began doing stand-up at a very early age. Mm-hmm. How did that transform into the one-woman show that has taken the world by storm, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch?
Well, I was like, God, look at that. And my dad is managing a comedy group. He's managing all these people. And there was this comedy group called, of all things, the Village Idiots, the best name ever. And they were hilarious. In fact, Jan Fisher was in the Village Idiots. She wrote the movie The Lost Boys. Mm. Mark Gansell went on to work on the TV show Coach. And Peter Jurasik, the actor Peter Jurasik, is in Babylon 5 and dozens of movies. But these people were all in this group. They all went on to be very famous. And so I was hanging around with them, and we'd go to the clubs. And literally, like out of a movie, I was heckling a guy. A guy was doing sort of an audience participation thing. And I was 15, right? So I started giving him a hard time. And he said the famous last words, if you think this is so easy, you ought to try it. Well, that was like daring me to do something. So next thing I know, I'm meeting with the Village Idiots and saying, what do I need to do? And they wrote me a stand-up act. And so I was 15 and a half when I first got up on stage. And by the time I was 16, I was doing four nights a week, the improv and the comedy stores, working all the time. And talk about overcoming shyness. So that really worked. And over the years, learning what worked, what didn't work, what audiences responded to, one of the things I saw is they all recognized me and they all wanted to talk about Little House. I would try to do stand-up and not talk about Little House. But as soon as I got to any point where I was talking to the audience, someone would say, you know, any questions? Yes, aren't you the girl who was on Little House on the Prairie? And you had to open with it. There was no getting around. It's like, yes, yes, it's me. And just like and I got a call to play New York. I'm fantastic. Never played New York. And they said, but you need to do like an hour and a half. And I was like, good God, who's got an hour and a half? And they said, oh, yeah, and Joan Rivers works this room. She's coming in, like, after you, so you know, you probably need to swear more. And I was like, what? Wait, what? Okay. And so I wrote an entirely new show. I thought, I got to come up with something. So I did, it was all true stories. I said, well, wait, you know, a friend of mine said, your act is great, but I like the stories you tell in the bar later. They're funnier. So I said, what if it was all true stories? It was all true stories from my life and all tied together with the running theme of, yes, people hate me, I was this bitch. And I did it. And I had a question and answer segment so the audience could participate. And they absolutely loved it. They went wild. And boy, the Q&A, I tell you, the Q&A segment is everybody's favorite thing. I love it. They love it. And I started doing that. And that was it. I said, well, this is the way to go. So I started doing that and adding to it and adding to it. And it became this, took on a life of its own. I started getting requests like mad. And then this guy, Patrick Louvatier, said, you know, we could do a French version of this. It would be kind of, I mean, you have to learn French. I have to do a whole adaptation, but it could be done. We could do a whole French version. I was like, you're insane. And then we did it. We completely did it. And we wound up doing the French version. And now I'm getting on a plane Sunday night to go to France and go do like six back-to-back shows.
That is wonderful. And did I see you're doing a radio show as well?
I know. Like, I don't have enough to do, right? So my friend said, why don't you have a show, a podcast, radio show? And there's a couple of stations in town that kind of do all the celebrity radio shows. All my friends were on them. And I'd been interviewed on most of them. And I talked to them. And over at UBN, UBN Go, they said, yes, come on. And so every Tuesday at 5 o'clock is the Allison Arngrim Show. And I interview a lot of celebrities, many of whom are friends of mine, and I find interesting authors and really cool people. Or, as I say, it's Allison Arngrim Show, where we talk about the things that make you feel good. And, you know, for instance, Michael Learned, who was on the Waltons. Yes, it had lots of people from Little House on the Prairie. And the shows that made you feel good, oh, Anson Williams from Happy Days, all these really cool people. But people who are also doing something now, because, like, Anson Williams, for example, now, he was on Happy Days. He was Foxy. We loved him.
And he's an inventor now, right?
Yes. Do you know his uncle was Dr. Heimlich of the Heimlich.
Right, but he was on with us a couple of months ago to talk about that.
You know, the drops, I have two of them in my purse right now, the little tubes, alert drops. They're the greatest thing. And it's lemon. It's citric acid. It's the lemon juice concentrate. So it's not going to hurt you. It's no caffeine, no drugs. And it works. You spray it on your tongue, and it's kind of like slapping yourself in the face a little bit. If you're driving, and as he said, Heimlich said, drowsy driving is extremely dangerous. The statistics are just crazy, the number of people who die from drowsy driving. If you're driving and you need to stop, and you think, I got to stop, I got to go home, I got to sleep, I got to get coffee, stop for a moment and spray these drops on your tongue, and you're good. You'll get home. And then because it's not speed, you'll be able to go to bed. but it's amazing. And he's doing this, and he put that out there. And, I mean, how many lives is he saving with these things? And I have to say, they're also really good for jet lag.
Ah, perfect.
You get off the plane, and, of course, me, flying 10 and a half hours, right? And the jet lag always hits about the time you need to get your bags. And the jet lag's in, you're like, but I need to be alert for a couple of more hours. I got to get a train. I got to get to the hotel. I can't fall asleep yet. And boom, alert drops. And it's perfect because then it kills enough of the jet lag. You're awake enough to get to the hotel, and then you can sleep.
Well, Allison, it is an absolute delight to talk with you. I loved your book. We wish you continued success. And again, happy birthday. Have a wonderful trip to France.
Thank you so much.
We hope you'll come back and visit with us again sometime.
I'd love to. Now, you're in Maine, right?
We are indeed, yes.
Okay, hi. I've been like once. I went to Algonquin. It was lovely. And I have friends from Maine, so yay, shout out. I'm in France, and then I'm in Fayetteville, Arkansas, the end of February, the 29th and 1st of March.
They're a lot alike. You won't be able to tell the difference.
What?
France and Fayetteville. It's like the same place, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, Fayetteville, Arkansas. I'm hearing that it's a very swinging place, actually. But yeah, it's so crazy. This is what I do. I'm like, oh, I'm in Berlin, and then I'm in Alabama. So kind of like all over the place. But yes, I'm going from Paris to Fayetteville. That's my schedule, seriously.
It's all about the journey. Allison, thank you again so much for visiting with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Allison Arngrim here on Dantan. Man, that was a blast. You never know with these things, but she was great.
That was a wonderful conversation to have. A lot of insight. I mean, child stars, it's a tough business to grow up in, but it sounds like the set of Little House was one that created some good people out of those child actors.
Yeah, and a lot of that because of Michael Landon and his, on the one hand, iron-fisted control and demanding professionalism, but that also meant that people were treated like professionals, even the young child actors as well. But very interesting stuff there with Allison Arngrim. When we come back, the Baseball Hall of Fame will announce this year's inductees in just a couple of days' time. We'll get some thoughts on that from Jay Jaffe of Fangraphs up next.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Central Street Farmhouse, downtown Bangor, for the best home brewing ingredients, equipment, and advice that you'll find anywhere. Plus, make your own wine right in the store. How does that work? Pick a wine kit, make an appointment, and whip up 6 gallons of the best wine you'll ever taste in less than 30 minutes. 2 months later, come back to bottle it and take it home. They offer these wine classes every day they're open, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Call 992-4454 or see them on Facebook to find out more.
What makes a community thrive? The people who live in it. When you use your First National Bank Visa debit card at participating local businesses, you save on everyday purchases while supporting the people who work day in and day out to make your town a vibrant, unique community. Receive cash back on purchases and support the local businesses that make our communities thrive. Bank local, buy local. Learn more at dreamfirstrewards.com. First National Bank. Dream first, because you can. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Penobscot Theater presents...
Hold on to your hat, old boy.
A fast-paced comedy.
There's something you didn't know about this weekend.
One night, two couples, and a table set with lies.
My wife wasn't supposed to be here.
Funny and a little bit naughty.
It made me so mad I could do unmentionable things.
Don't Dress for Dinner, January 30th through February 16th at Bangor's Historic Opera House. Tickets at 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org.
Dinner is served.
We're back on the best of downtown for your Sunday morning. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell here on Z62. Baseball Hall of Fame getting ready to announce its new class of inductees this week. And with thoughts on that... we turn to a Hall of Fame expert, Jay Jaffe of FanGraphs and the author of the Cooperstown Casebook. Let's talk about the Hall. I've been loving the series of pieces you've been doing on FanGraphs about the one-and-dones. They were great.
Oh, thank you.
My favorite, I think, of all of them. Well, a couple of them, and they were actually together. Carlos Pena, a guy I got to call some of his games when he was playing his college ball at Northeastern.
Oh, wow.
And he was one of those guys that didn't have the career that people projected for him, but an interesting story.
Yeah, definitely. And it took a very interesting path to the majors in that his parents, his family emigrated from the Dominican Republic settled in Massachusetts, and he had two brothers that were also ball players, one of whom played professionally, and he went to Northeastern and studied engineering. Really interesting guy. I've actually done television with him before at MLB Network. Obviously very intelligent. What he knows goes well beyond the baseball field. And he had some big years there for the Rays. He was a transformative figure in their history. He joined them in 2007, had a big season after so many disappointments with the Tigers and the A's and the Rangers and being traded and bouncing around briefly to the Yankees and Red Sox as well. Suddenly put it all together in Tampa Bay and was a huge figure for them, part of that 2008 pennant-winning team, and led the league in homers once, and just a very interesting career.
And another guy who had some moments and put up some overall good numbers, Alfonso Soriano, 412 career homers, nearly 300 stolen bases, a 28.2 WAR. What's keeping him out of the Hall and making him likely a one and done?
Well, he wasn't much of a defender either at second base or in left field. He had some big seasons in left field initially when he could still utilize his speed, but knee problems slowed him down. He was a hacker. I mean, he had years where he had his on-base percentages were around 300 or lower. He was I think it was his rookie year. It took him till like 25th game to draw his first walk. tremendous power, tremendous speed. 40-40 season. The last of the four 40-40 seasons in baseball history was done by him in 2006. Multiple 30-30 seasons. A lot of fun to watch, kind of an erratic ball player. In some senses.
We're talking with Jay Jaffe here on Downtown. So beyond the obvious, and I guess to me that would be Derek Jeter, out of this group that's on the ballot this year, and let's move the steroid guys to the side for a moment, who else should be?
Well, I'm a big proponent and have been for years of Larry Walker's case. It's going to be a nail-biter as to whether he gets in this year, his 10th and final one on the writer's ballot. He's made a nearly unprecedented climb from the dregs. He was only getting about 10 to 11% a few years ago, but the work of the stat heads like myself has shined a light on his merits and really underscored the extent to which he was a true five-tool player, excelling on the bases and in the field as well as at the plate, and adjusting for his time at altitude with the Rockies when he put up some video game-like numbers. But I think it's going to be a nail-biter. I'm hopeful he gets in, but if not this way, then I think by the ERA committee down the road.
What about Scott Rowland?
Scott Rowland is making some big advances. He's a guy kind of that fits that mold where the analytics, I think, are really helping him. Right now, the early published votes, he's got over 50%. I think he's probably going to wind up closer to 40%, but that would be more than doubling what he got last year, which was about 17% in his second year on the ballot. Again, another guy whose case I'm a big proponent of and happy to see it. Also seeing gains from guys like Todd Helton and Gary Sheffield, two guys who I'm behind, more so Helton in terms of my statistical system, the JAWS methodology, than Sheffield. But I have a very visceral appreciation for the latter, having watched him up close with the Yankees.
Any shot for Jeff Kent, or is that passed?
You know, I'm kind of surprised that Kent has lagged to the extent that he has. I always figured that having that home run record for second baseman and being a 100 RBI guy several times and having an MVP award on his mantle would make it pretty smooth sailing for him. But, you know, he was a prickly character. The advanced stats don't really favor him all that well. Kind of a middling on-base percentage for a big slugger and bad defensive metrics, and he's really lagged. He's been below 20% for several years, and right now, even with the additional ballot space for voters to play with, they've put some of the guys we just talked about ahead of him, and he's getting only about 28%. So I would say he's probably a guy who could do well in front of the ERA committee, not unlike Jack Morris a couple of years ago, and Fred McGriff probably the next time around. I think Kent's the guy who, if he's going to get into the Hall, it's going to be through that route.
Bobby Abreu, to me, is an interesting case. Maybe it's because he was around a long time, and I forget how good he was, but then you look at the numbers.
He was so quietly excellent, just an on-base machine, good power, great speed. The big problem for him was that he escaped notice, particularly in those years in Philadelphia when he was at his best. Only made two All-Star teams, won one Gold Glove before his defense really deteriorated. He's struggling to get to maintain a share above 5%. I'm not terribly optimistic about that. I think if he does, he'll survive for another year on the ballot, maybe even a couple, but I don't think we're going to see a large scale movement of voters. I think we're seeing it's Gary Sheffield and Larry Walker among the right fielders that are getting the additional support here with this space, not Abreu. And it's kind of saddening, but I wish he'd done just a little more to make it more of a slam dunk case.
Did the Today's Game committee do it right? I was a little surprised. First of all, I was glad to see Dwight Evans finish third because I'm incredibly biased toward Dewey, but I loved him as a kid growing up. I was surprised that Dale Murphy didn't do that well.
Yeah, there were so many. That was a packed ballot. And the putting Lou Whitaker and Dwight Evans and Thurman Munson back into circulation in this format after, you know, after so many years of being on the sidelines. Whitaker hadn't been on a ballot since 2001 when he went one and done with the Riders. Evans since 1999 when he was on his third time around with the Riders. Munson had only been on that expanded Veterans Committee ballot at the bottom there when in the early 2000s when they were letting the living Hall of Famers vote. There were just so many directions for voters to be pulled. Ultimately, what happened was that the two guys who had come one vote short in past elections, Ted Simmons and Marvin Miller, both of whom I've advocated for countless times, were the ones who'd got in. I thought Evans made a very solid showing his first time around. I would like to have seen Whitaker done a little bit better, but he got six votes in a very competitive field. Murphy, you know, he's not a guy who does particularly well by my system, but I said this in the wake of Harold Baines' election last year, that if there was anybody I could stomach being waved through despite my own analytical misgivings, if you will, it was Murphy. I mean, a two-time MVP, shortish career, but regarded widely as the best player in baseball for a period of time there. You know, I just think that the big thing for these guys when they vote is the counting stats. And if you're short of 400 home runs, as he is, even just short, and with that short career, you know, he's being penalized for the lack of longevity.
Well, unfortunately, the people who vote don't always look at your research, the Jaws numbers, yeah, and others who have put so much time into this. So who do you think will end up getting elected this year?
Well, you know, I think obviously Jeter. I think Curt Schilling is going to be short. I don't see him changing enough minds quickly enough to close the gap from the 63% he had last year.
I think so.
63%. I think he'll put himself in position to be elected next year, perhaps, or eventually by the time his 10-year eligibility runs out. I think other than that, it's Walker or bust. You know, it could be a one-man class. It could be a two-man class. I don't think it's going to be a three-man class. You know, when you look to next year, there's no obvious first-time candidate hitting the ballot next year. So we could be in for some lean years here in the near future.
Well, we're looking forward to the announcement coming up next week. If you haven't done so already, get a copy of the Cooperstown Casebook and find out all you need to know about so many great baseball players through the years. And I'm told, Jay, I mean, I saw it on social media, so it must be true that if you place your beer next to the Cooperstown Casebook, it'll make whatever beer that is taste that much better.
Yes, that's true. A couple of my friends photographed the cover of my book next to their drinks recently, and I took that as quite the endorsement. So fun stuff.
It's Jay Jaffe, author of the Cooperstown Casebook, and we'll find out who's going in the Baseball Hall of Fame coming up, I believe, on Tuesday. The announcement will be made. Our thanks to Jay, the great Bob Ryan, and Allison Arngrim of Little House on the Prairie, and thanks to you for joining us on this Sunday morning. Long weekend, too. Holiday tomorrow. Is it a station holiday tomorrow, Kerry?
It is not a station holiday.
Oh, okay. Because it's not a downtown holiday. We'll be here.
That is true.
we've got a great show tomorrow and a terrific week of guests coming up for you. Tomorrow on the program, Mrs. C herself, Marion Ross of Happy Days, will join us. Talk about her book, My Days, Happy and Otherwise, and of course her incredible career. Although it took her a long time, she's one of those people who, you know, much like Bryan Cranston, who sort of worked in the trenches doing small roles, and then all of a sudden Happy Days hit and changed her life. We'll chat about that. Also tomorrow, Chad Finn of the Boston Globe and the whole baseball scandal, Patriots and more. Alan Adams with movie reviews. Among the guests this week, Tuesday, actress Lynn Stewart, Miss Yvonne from Pee-wee's Playhouse will visit with us. On Wednesday, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Dave Clark of the Dave Clark Five. And on Thursday's show, actress Joyce Bulifant, who was in everything back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. She was in the movie Airplane. She was Murray Slaughter's wife, Marie, on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and did all those 70s game shows, Match Game, password, $10,000 pyramid as well. Some fun conversations coming up this week on Downtown. Hope you'll be here for all of them starting at 4 every weekday right here on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna be